Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Joining the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Jeff Frederick, are Bob Pogue from the Department of Biology, Porter Lillis from the Department of Sociology, and Eric Freeman, an EMS expert and educator. Their topic, the mysteries of the human body.
The human body is a marvelous compilation of various organic materials that proves itself over and over again to be remarkably resilient, full of irony, and replete with mysteries that aren't easily solved. Case in point, humans appear to be born with about 270 bones, but by adulthood, fusions and development have reduced the axial skeleton to around 80 and the appendicular skeleton to 126. In short, we start with about 270 and end with 206. How does that happen? Okay, so how many muscles do we have? Well, the quick and common answer is about 300, but if you're talking to certain specialists, they will say the number is closer to 700. We could categorize muscles into skeletal or movement muscles, cardiac or blood-moving muscles, and smooth, which unfortunately are the ones that help us to move our bowels. Not exactly perfect for a podcast. But in fact, many of these so-called smooth muscles are so small that it becomes hard to determine when one stops and when another starts. About a gallon and a half of blood is currently in the typical human body, with the liver and kidneys in a constant state of filtering to move toxins and waste along in the system and eventually, with the help of the rest of the digestive system, out of the body. Meanwhile, the lymph system is also in the cleaning business, taking some dead cells and other detritus and helping to distribute and eject them. Perhaps the best cleaner and purifier in the body is the lungs, which work without rest and make a constant handshake with oxygen coming in and carbon dioxide going out. By the way, all of these cleaning and detoxifying systems work more effectively with exercise. So if you're thinking of starting a walking program, getting back to the gym, or scheduling a couple of tennis or yoga sessions per week, go ahead and do it. It's science. Exercise may be more important for keeping the internal parts functioning than it is for getting the external parts ready for beach season. Which brings us to the matter of our skin, which for the average person covers about 2 square meters of surface area and accounts for about 15% of our total body weight and conveniently houses about 11 miles worth of blood vessels. Part protective covering, part thermostat, and regulator of core temperature, skin exfoliates itself so efficiently that a new external layer develops about once a month. Where does that old skin go? Mostly into your vacuum cleaner, I think, as dead cells are a part of the dust you sweep up off the carpet every week or maybe every month. Oh, and if you're squeamish, you don't even want to think about the amount of bacteria, much of it you actually do want, that is residing quite happily on your skin. All of this is navigated by a central processing unit called the brain, where about 100 trillion neural connections are firing and communicating to make sure all of these physical, mental, emotional, and intellectual functions are working in some form of symmetry. It's a mystery how it all works. At least it's a mystery to me. All the more puzzling is that life itself is so incredibly precious, we will spend, on average across America, almost $11,000 on healthcare for a body whose tangible worth, skin and chemical properties and various agents, is estimated by the Mayo Clinic to be worth about $4.50. Today's topic is the mystery of the human body, and we're joined by an interesting group of experts who study the human body from many different perspectives. Bob Pogue is a biologist, and he'll tell you more about specifically what he does. Porter Lillis is a medical sociologist, and Eric Freeman is an EMS expert, practitioner, and educator. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. What are some of the most remarkable characteristics and qualities of the human body? In other words, Bob, tell me something about the human body that most of us don't know.
Well, you gave a great introduction to the human body and some of the major organ systems, and one of my big teaching assignments here is anatomy and physiology. And in that, we talk about different organ systems as if they are independent units. So you've got the circulatory system, and it does this. You've got the respiratory system, it does that. And in the advanced physiology courses and in the practice of medicine, I think it becomes really clear that all of these systems interact with each other all the time. And if there is a breakdown in communication between those systems, that's one place that disease begins to become apparent. And the command and control entities in charge there are not just the brain and the nervous system, but the endocrine system as well. My background's in neurobiology, so I was very familiar when I came to Pembroke with the functioning of the brain and the way nerves work and nerve cells communicate with each other. And what I've found in teaching anatomy and physiology over the years is that the endocrine system, the immune system, and the nervous system together really generate a web of communication between all these systems in which you can affect the function of one system in about 50 different ways, probably. You're not really limited to, the brain tells the muscle to contract, and the brain tells the smooth muscle when to contract in the gut. There are a lot of different ways that can work, including interactions between the microbiome, the bacterial community that you mentioned, and these other systems. So it's a very intricate system, which I think doesn't surprise anybody, but we're learning enough about how these systems interact with each other. There are some very cool ways to treat disease and to help the human body kind of grow and develop in the pace and the rate that it really needs to, that we wouldn't even have known about 20 years ago.
So part of it all comes back to communication, right? Are they all the systems talking to each other and hearing what the other one is saying?
Absolutely. And we're finding out things about the mechanisms of communication that are totally unexpected. The idea that the gut bacteria could affect your immune system or your nervous system was totally unheard of not very long ago. And we've had visiting scholars come and give talks about this kind of things. I'm always fascinated at how quickly things are changing as we understand that communication. We're finding out whole new things about what's really messing the body up in the first place.
What about the rest of y'all? Tell me something remarkable about the body that we don't necessarily all know.
This is very much related to what you just brought up. Talking about the gut biome communicating, what's really interesting from the sociological perspective is our social interactions with one another. We're not in a vacuum, and we're realizing biologically more and more our social behavior is messing up our own biomes, whether it's through skin cleaning. I am not advocating not bathing, and I am not advocating drinking pond water, but our social behaviors are removing us from our environment more and more. In fact, a lot of the studies coming out, we're realizing that contracting some diseases and experiencing some challenges helps with this epigenetics, which literally means just turning on and off switches. So socially, being happy makes you better. Being unhappy will hurt your body in a myriad of ways, which we can talk about. But that social environment that you're in also contributes to your physical health simply by what you're around and the toxins or the healthy foods that you're getting. And again, it's a very simple mechanism to describe it this way. There's much more complex things going on under the hood. But the turning on and off of switches and triggering things is something that I think a lot of people can wrap their heads around. Stay up too late at night with the television on, your brain thinks it's daytime, and pretty soon your circadian rhythms are out of whack.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I think you have to look at it from a standpoint of the body wants to stay happy. The body wants to live in a happy environment. We do things from time to time that dictate that, and it moves that from one shift to another. But in our world, in the EMS world, we try to make fast changes on a slow-moving body. It's the way we look at it. We have patients for 30 minutes at the most, and we turn them over to a doctor. So most of our drugs and our medications and our procedures are fast-acting procedures. I think one of the biggest things we have to remember is that the body wants to stay happy. The body wants to live in a homeostatic state, and anything we can do to keep it there is going to make everything better.
And that's a good point. I mean, once the body gets out of the range at which it's really designed to function and when those communication mechanisms are working really well, the body can do amazing things. We can live at an altitude of, 15,000 feet. We can live at sea level. We can live below sea level. We can live with different types of nutrients, with different types of stressors. But once we get out of that range where the body's communication systems can kind of, turn down the liver, turn up the adrenal glands, get the musculature able to release energy at a rate, and a lot of people don't know that muscles actually release a lot of energy-producing molecules. And that control system works under a huge variety of environmental effects, including sociological effects. You can live by yourself for a certain amount of time, and some people are better at it than others. Some people don't do it all well in a crowd. Some people do really, really well living by themselves. And there are some differences in body systems that maybe can account for that. But once you get outside of the comfort level that your body can really handle, where those systems don't work well, where you're no longer able to regulate things, that's when you really get into trouble. And these kind of acute procedures are needed to sort of bump things back into the window where your body can take control of it.
Kind of the restore back to original factory setting switch.
Yeah. Yeah. We call it the control alt delete.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Other thing on that, I think, is the body does a great job keeping us in that window, but we have very small margin for error once we get outside that window. We can't move far once our pH gets off. We can't deteriorate too far before it's deadly.
Well, let's stay on that. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that we do on a regular basis that actually stress the body or put the body in a situation where some of those switches don't fire as well. What is it that we ask the body to do on a regular basis that maybe we shouldn't?
I'm going to go first, not to be too ethereal. We've changed the demands. In the 1900s, the top three causes of death were acute diseases. You had the courtesy to get sick and drop dead quickly. And in this current era, our greatest causes of death, top three, top four, depending on who you ask, are because of chronic conditions where you have the ability to stick around 35, 40 years with this condition maintained. It's because of our lifestyle differences, our changes in the production, overproduction of food, underproduction of labor, or the unnecessary need for labor now. We completely changed the world in which we evolved to live in so quickly that we haven't adapted to it yet.
It's fascinating. I think just following up on this, my training as a historian, the same war wound that you might have gotten in the Civil War and killed you in World War I, you might have survived a little bit longer. In World War II, you might have lived but lost a limb. In Vietnam, you might have lived and lost half of a limb because of the state of medical care and the ability to respond quickly to an acute condition changes. And now as a culture, we have, fortunately for so many people, we now have a place where people do live much longer with chronic conditions, but it does change some of this calculus.
So does the chronic, I'm wondering if you can answer this, does the chronic, the fact that we have a lot of people who are chronically, very slowly having decrease in their body's function, I mean, that not only stresses them out, but the rest of society has to adjust to kind of carry the weight for these people and keep them above ground. So it stresses out the family unit. It stresses out all the social structures associated with that. Is that where you were going?
I'm not going to I don't want to attack that anyone's still alive and they're placing a burden on the system. I just merely wanted to mention where in the 1900s you're worried about a pterodactyl picking your kid up at the bus stop or getting yellow fever. Those low-hanging fruit because of development of potable water and good sanitation and these public health measures have taken away the things that normally took people out quickly. Now we're living long enough to experience these other wonderful ways of dying, unfortunately, but we get to live longer and we're able to deal with them. But the problem is they're man-made. It's the man-made, our wonderful world of overproduction of food and these resources that allow us to do so well are also taking a toll on us if we're not able to exercise appropriately or get as much physical activity as we used to. So our social changes are bringing this about. I'm personally glad a lot of grandmothers or grandfathers are still around.
Well, let's talk about how the body heals itself and tries to reactivate some of those switches when it gets in trauma. Maybe, Eric, you can start with us. Let's say a body undergoes some physical trauma as a result of an accident or whatever. How does the body immediately go to work to try to help heal itself? And then over time, how do other systems within the body try to help out in order to complete the task that begins almost immediately after an injury?
I'll focus on trauma. In a trauma incident, the body is going to attack that area first. The body's going to send its, what we call its little warriors there, its white blood cells or whatever. It's going to perfuse more blood to the area to try to heal it. In return, the body's smart enough to realize that if I can't fix this, then I'm going to save what I need most. And at that point, it starts pulling back. It's retreat mode. It shunts all the blood to the core, and it takes care of the heart, the lungs, the liver. And from that point, the limb's on its own.
So it, like, diagnoses itself immediately. There's a problem. Let me go send support to the sector. And then if it thinks that that sector can't fix itself, it reprioritizes certain systems?
Exactly. It reprioritizes the system. And the system that is most important, that's the one it's going to take care of. It's going to send all its extra forces there, whether it's blood, sugar, oxygen, all that's going to what it needs to keep itself sustaining.
What about more midterm and long-term after an injury has been stabilized? How does the body go about the process of repairing itself?
Well, if things are working right, the initial response involves some hormonal changes, the kind of fight-or-flight response when you're injured. You know, the hair stands up on your legs and your heart rate increases and the smooth muscle in the vasculature changes its tension to change blood pressure, heart rate changes, those kinds of things to get blood moving effectively. Hopefully, over time, those things will back off and kind of go back to a more normal status. But if someone's in a lot of pain or has experienced a significant trauma, and the whole idea of post-traumatic stress syndrome is something that I find fascinating, but it's really difficult to wrap my head around exactly what's going on, but the body doesn't respond in a way that is really in line with the current threat level. So instead of responding to a broken bone by releasing all these hormones that and activating the immune system in ways that'll start healing that bone and then shutting off once the next set of mechanisms needs to go into play, where you're actually, you know, dividing cells in the area and causing them to start activating the healing process, making scar tissue that can then be replaced by bone and that sort of thing. Sometimes the command and control mechanisms get out of whack and keep that healing from initiating. You keep that early kind of panic response going for longer. And one aspect of that is that it doesn't allow the secondary mechanisms that are beginning the more physical healing process to begin. It throws those out of whack. Somebody who's in a stressful environment and trying to heal is going to take longer to heal. Somebody who doesn't feel comfortable and safe where they are is probably going to take longer to heal. And the mechanisms of that are really difficult to pull out.
The other factor that plays into that also is your pre-existing conditions prior to the injury. Was it hypertension? Was it diabetes? Was it circulational issues? Circulatory system, your healing is only as good as your circulatory system is going to be in the initial phases. So I think your pre-existing conditions, as far as your long-term healing, plays a very important factor.
So no trauma exists in a vacuum, in other words. If you have other systems that need to support the part of the body that just underwent something and those were damaged prior to the injury, then your recovery time is going to be lengthened. Your condition may become chronic, whereas otherwise, assuming all other systems were in good shape, it might have been fairly easy to recover from.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. I think if the body has to focus on a broke leg, it's going to fix that broke leg much easier and much quicker than it is if it's focusing on a broke leg, hypertension, diabetes, excessive sugar in the bloodstream, several different things. So it's working on five things instead of one. Whereas if the pre-existing conditions aren't there or they are under control with medications or exercise or diet, then the healing of the acute injury is going to happen much quicker.
Yeah, and some of those compounds, there are some compounds that the body uses for multiple purposes. So if you've, instead of just sending out the white blood cells to, you know, work in one region to fight an infection, if you also need them to be moving in another direction and doing something else, you've got very few things in the body have just one function. Mm-hmm. So the more you're overtaxing thing, it's like if you've got a, you know, secretary or somebody who's working with you and you tell them to do 10 things at once, well, they're probably not going to be as effective.
And so Porter, like in a geriatric situation where people have longstanding pre-existing physical conditions, maybe some mental issues, maybe some financial worries, does that all complicate a healing process?
I think you just operationally defined complicated. Yes, absolutely. The body remembers the hits, not the misses. And there's this weathering effect with these chronic conditions. Over time, they accumulate. Absolutely.
So even though there might be value in getting daily care, for example, living in an assisted living facility, there might be other benefits of remaining at home that might help your mental and emotional outlook.
Right. Now we're bringing more than just the somatic response of the body, the corporeal self. Yeah, absolutely. Mentally, if you're happier, and we do know actually that people are happier aging in place, even if your neighborhood's falling around you, quick segue, if your neighborhood's falling around you but you have wonderful memories about the place, and if you have diminished eyesight, diminished capacity, you're still familiar with those surroundings, and that's enough to sustain you much better than if you're taken away to a very sterile, nice place where everybody's wonderful to you, but you have there's no emotional relationship with that place.
So there is some value in focusing on things that make you happy or that give you warm memories, and maybe even laughter is maybe not the best, but it's a pretty good medicine?
It's at least number two.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. These are very fantastic things. And implied there, if they're in this wonderful place and they're happy, then their social group is there or they're maintaining social ties. And what we're talking about is maintaining a locus of control. There's this sense of purpose, which is incredibly necessary, even if it's just to get up and play my PS4 this morning, which I did not. I had a function.
Nobody's judging.
I had a function. My clan needs me. So this is very much better. And also the person you just described, that stereotype, we realize and recognize that they're diminishing. It's a normal senescence. There's a normal aging process. But we can keep them happy, for as long as possible. And they're more able to deal with the loss of function and diminished capacity if there's still that locus of control, that sense of importance. So we can still do a lot while that range of motion might actually be very small, or that space that they occupy becomes smaller daily.
We'll return to 30 Brave Minutes in a moment, but first, thank you for listening and for your financial support of the College of Arts and Sciences. The Dean's Fund exists to help students and faculty make meaningful connections to the community, the state, and beyond through intellectual inquiry, scholarships, and research in the humanities, social sciences, and STEM fields. Consider a contribution today. Mark your envelope, the Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNC Pembroke, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372, or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. And now, back to 30 Brave Minutes and your host, Jeff Frederick.
Talk about some interesting things that we don't know. In other words, if I could empower you to solve one more mystery of the human body, where would you go?
Wow. Just one? Well, different things pop into my head all the time. That's why I think I'm in the right field. I think studying the brain, for me, there's so much we don't know, and there's so much that, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, everything that's interesting about human life comes from the way our brain works. There are some people who will respond really well to pet therapy, for instance, and there are some people who would totally flip out if you put a cat down on them when they're in the middle of the healing process. There are people who respond to the presence of friends and family. There are others who respond to nature, which I would be really interested to hear how non-human animals who've remained in their natural setting compare in their neurobiology to humans, animals, like everyone listening, probably, unless you have a dog or cat with you, in which case tell them I said hi. But being out of the environment where we evolved, what are we really doing to ourselves? And what can we do to get back some of the advantages that we spent how long? Tens of thousands of years evolving to work in that environment at what point do we need to just, is it really in our best interest to go back to it? I just spent a week in Montana with family and friends, and I have rarely been happier than I was out on a stream. It felt like the right place for me, and, you know, life gets stressful sometimes, and what works for me to de-stress may not work for someone else. I imagine somebody who grew up in inner city New York would not be happy out on a stream somewhere slapping bugs and listening to things crashing through the woods. And I'm curious what it is about the evolution of the human brain and its control abilities that what can we really do to make people more able to put themselves in a comfortable state?
Socially speaking, we can't unring that bell. That'd be asking a whole lot of people and a whole lot of things to go away. But I'm in complete agreement. How can we return that sense of working in cooperation, being part of nature, rather than in living in these wonderful structures, these large cities that brought about medicine and wonderful products that we all enjoy? There's not enough space for everybody to have that at one time. But if we can figure out a really good system, and this is a nod to all of the Western European countries that have this mandatory holiday, we can't stay in the cubicle the entire time. We know how bad it is for us. If we can find a way to find a proper sense of not at work and at work in these human man-made structures, and fly fishing, I hope, is what you're referencing.
Oh, yes.
We'll talk about flies later.
Work-life balance, then,
yes,
has a really positive effect on physical as well as mental well-being.
And that has almost nothing in common with our capitalist-driven rewarding the investors with dividends. And I'm absolutely a huge fan of all the things that these things have given us. But the people that are working it out in the trenches day to day, they're not enjoying any of the benefits that we recognize in other countries that are necessary in order for them to be able to do this not only healthfully but also happily. And so working that out, we're getting much better. We're working now on more family leave projects, working on better holidays. So it is finding that balance, but that's what's most important for me, is working out how to be part of nature again, even for a time.
Breakthroughs come in lots of different forms. Let's say in addition to some rest and some work-life balance and to commuting more with nature and cutting the cord every once in a while, what would be the other things that you would say from each of your disciplines that would make the body more efficient, more healthy, other than, you ought to walk around the block every once in a while?
I feel like I'm going to be in Eric's camp. It would be nice if we weren't doing drugs like processed sugar all the time. It would be nice if we weren't consuming a lot of processed foods with a lot of hormones. Again, throwing switches on and off that we're not familiar with. A really good diet is probably going to look really, really boring. But I think that would be, for me, that's the most primary thing that we can do before sleep, but before exercise, is actually getting proper nutrients on board and not calorie-dense foods, negative nutrient, that are just causing us more issues that we're trying to battle that. That would be the first step for me.
I saw a thing in one of the online sites I was looking at this week that there's now even more conclusive studies that diet soda actually makes you gain weight.
I heard something about that. I haven't looked into it, but that, I mean, the decisions that people make, it seem to be, and maybe you can comment on this, Eric, as much of a problem in our disease process and in our getting ourselves in trouble medically, more than anything like our genetics or our technology. You know, texting and driving, all that stuff's bad, obviously. But I hear about a lot of people who, if you just take your medication, you're going to be okay. If you really just lose 30 pounds, none of this will be happening. If you move out when you realize that all your roommates are, selling drugs or whatever, just you put yourself in a situation, make a decision that removes you from danger and follow your physician's advice. There's a big component of that to, I think, any kind of, putting people in medical danger. Would you agree?
I agree. I would say our decisions that we make, for one, like you said, non-compliant with our medications, that's huge. A lot of people that we see are non-compliant for several reasons. One, maybe they can't afford them. One, maybe they don't have an education level to know what to take or when to take. And always that third person that just doesn't do it. But I agree. I think removing ourselves from the stressors that we put ourselves in front of every day, laughing, is something that we're big on in our world. You know, we see stuff on a daily basis that people don't want to see in a lifetime. And how do we take care of that? And how do we treat that as we laugh about it when we get in the truck, you know, to each other? That's our treatment. We would never do that in public, but that's kind of how we do it. But I do think the decisions that we make for ourselves, or our lack of decisions as human beings, dictates our physicians. So I think our physicians, we could save a lot of physician visits if we would make good decisions outside the office. And then when we go, I think society's got to a point that we feel like it's okay, I can eat that barbecue because I got high blood pressure medicine at home to take care of it. And I think we've evolved to that point of I don't have to lose weight because I can treat my cholesterol and my high blood pressure with medications, instead of losing weight, exercising, and being compliant. I think we've got to a point that our medicine cabinet can keep us in a homeostatic state more outside of our real nature.
Well, I'd say that's what advertising from some medical device companies and pharmaceutical companies would want us to believe. They list all the side effects, but they don't mention, take this or lose 30 pounds.
Right. Pharmacology has a lot of benefits. We're thankful we have it, but it's not the, it shouldn't be the only club in our bag.
And it may not be the best club for most people. If our communities could somehow, you know, fight this, I have real concerns about the way media affects decisions related to health. And the way our kids are plugged in all the time, and I'll tell you what, there are a lot of neurobiologists working for advertising companies. They know what buttons to push to make the brain change its state to push towards a certain behavior. I mean, it's a little cynical, I think, but it would also be naive to think that that doesn't happen. I mean, we are, in some sense, being manipulated every day by advertising. And I tell my kids all the time, I hate that commercial. Turn it off. Doesn't matter what it is. I hate it. I may like Snickers bars, but I don't like being pushed.
We don't want to beat up too much on my fellow barbecue eaters. We're very social creatures. The media tells us what to think, but and they might have a very specific message to sell a product, and so we have a slightly negative feeling about them. But our grandparents didn't set out to make us sick or obese. This is how we eat, and we follow the social scripts and the social norms of our families that we grew up with. If you grew up with vegetarians, congratulations. You have a greater appreciation of broccoli than I ever will. But if you grew up in the South like many of us, there are a lot of comfort foods. And here's how you know what your essential nature is. When you just had the worst day of your life or the best day of your life, if you just been dumped or you just got engaged, you're probably going to put the car in D and just hold the wheel and do slow circles around the Bojangles parking lot and have them throw things at you. This is what we grew up with. These are very emotional things that we're putting into our bodies. We often don't think about it that way. It takes a lot of energy when you've been dumped or broken up or fired to go get sushi or a salad. It takes a lot of wherewithal.
And in the end, we all just wish that Mama was there to give us what she cooked when we were this high.
That's right. And also, the last club in the bag would be genetics. You know, genetics, sometimes people can do all they can do, and we're still going to need that medication.
That's right. There are people who literally can't eat bacon and eggs every day and make all the wrong decisions and yet live to be 90 years old. And those are mysteries perhaps left for us to solve. Well, I've learned a lot today. I've learned how sophisticated our communication system is within our body and how we need to put it in a state where all of the different elements of our well-being have an opportunity to work together in order for us to be truly the bodies and the minds and the souls that we're designed to be. Thank you all for coming and enlightening us. This is a great panel today. Thank you all for listening. Check in with us next time on 30 Brave Minutes.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves.
Cheers.
Thanks, everybody. That was really good.
So smart.
Yeah.
Do I still have a job?
Of course you do. Yes.
I'll let y'all know when I get back.